We come now to the story of Abraham. You might say that the whole of the first 11 chapters of Genesis have really been a build-up for the introduction of Abraham. Abraham is the central character of the book. And what has gone before has shown us how God has prepared the way for this salvation which he is going to bring to mankind through Abraham. God created man. Man sinned. God in his grace didn't wipe him out. He has preserved a godly line right through until we arrive at this man, Abraham. And what God is now going to do is to develop through Abraham his way of salvation. He promises Abraham that he will have descended from him a great multitude of people, and they'll become a nation. Because they're a nation, they have to have somewhere to live. So God will give them somewhere to live, namely the country of Canaan, or Palestine as we call it today. And from this people, God will then bring a person, namely Jesus Christ, and he will be the saviour of the world. The first three verses of chapter 12 of Genesis are really a key to the understanding of the whole of the rest of the Bible. The Lord said to Abram — Abram was what he was called before he was called Abraham, and his wife Sarah was previously called Sarai. If I happen to use the names interchangeably, well, it's the same person, Abraham or Abram. Now the Lord said to Abram, "Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you." There's the land. "I will make of you a great nation," so there's the people, "and I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and him who curses you I will curse, and by you shall all families of the earth be blessed." And there's the reference to the fact that the blessing is now going to flow out from Abraham, from his people, through the Messiah, Jesus Christ, to all peoples of the world. Abraham at that stage was still in Ur of the Chaldees, which is ancient Babylonia there in Mesopotamia. The promise that we've just read was repeated later to Abraham's son Isaac, later on to his son Jacob, and that was the basis on which the whole of the nation of Israel was constructed. What I want to do today as we move through chapters 12 to 23 is to see how this promise began to be fulfilled. And in fact, I'm suggesting that the whole of the rest of Genesis, all those colourful stories about Jacob and Joseph, all of those stories are there to show us how these three verses are being fulfilled. And bear in mind the two particular things: the promise of the nation, the people, and the promise of the land. The Bible story up until now, as we've seen, has been centered in Mesopotamia. All the places we met previously were there. Now the center of focus is going to shift over to Palestine. First of all, we find that Abraham and his family move from southern Mesopotamia up to northern Mesopotamia in the land of Aram, and they settle briefly in a place called Haran. What I'm going to do now is make references to the places on the map all the way through the study to show how these movements took place and let the whole story unfold itself in relation to the places where Abraham moved. The last verse of chapter 11 tells us that Terah, that is Abraham's father, died in Haran. Abraham stayed there for a while before moving south into Palestine. Notice the route that he followed. It's called the Fertile Crescent. You've met this in your studies at school, probably. In ancient times, that's the way they travelled from Mesopotamia into Palestine, over that crescent. They didn't go straight across because that was largely desert, so they followed the Tigris-Euphrates Valley up through the north and then down into Canaan. Well, that's the way Abraham was moving. But he stopped briefly at Haran. We're not told why he stopped there, but the suggestion is that his father, for some reason, was not able to continue the journey, and it was not until his father died that Abraham kept going. And if that is the reason, there's a very good lesson for us, that our family responsibilities come first. Our responsibilities to each other as husband and wife, to our children, to our parents. These responsibilities come first, and we must not use some sort of call of God to a distant field to excuse ourselves from those responsibilities. Only after those responsibilities have first been seen to can we move on further afield. Well, from verse 32 of chapter 11, we come down now to chapter 12, verse 5. The end of verse 4 says, "Abraham departed from Haran, he and Sarai his wife, and Lot," who was Abraham's nephew, "they and all their possessions came into the land of Canaan," at the end of verse 5. And in verse 6, "they passed through the land to the place at Shechem." Notice Shechem there on the map. So they are now well and truly in Canaan. Now from here on, we're going to be concerned only with that southern part of Palestine, so I'm going to replace this map now with an enlargement of that section there. Notice the place Shechem, and get your bearings from that now in this second map. You'll see a reference there in chapter 12, verse 6, at the very end of verse 6, that the Canaanites were in the land. The Canaanites were the people of Canaan, which sounds a bit obvious. They were descendants of Canaan, who was one of Ham's sons. There were many different tribal groups in this area. Canaanites, Amorites, Hittites, Hivites, Perizzites, Jebusites, and many, many other ites. Frequently you'll find that all of these people are summarized under one or two prominent names. Sometimes they're called Canaanites, sometimes they're called Amorites, sometimes they were called Hittites. They were the three dominant groups. So as you move through, you'll find these expressions, Canaanites, Hittites, and Amorites, are used sometimes of the different ethnic groups, but generally they're used as broad terms covering the whole of the people of that land. From Shechem, in verse 8, he had moved to Bethel. And it tells us that in Bethel, at the end of the verse, he built an altar to the Lord and called on the name of the Lord. This was an expression of his faith. This is the land God had sent him to, and here he is right in the middle of the land which God has promised him. And to express his faith in God, that God has given him this land, he erects this altar as a sort of memorial. He gives an outward demonstration of his faith. As we would say in modern language, you put your money where your mouth is. It's all right to say something, but let's see some sort of demonstration. Are you prepared to risk your cash on the deal? Well, here Abraham, so to speak, puts his money where his mouth is. He had believed, but now he's saying, I'm giving a visible demonstration of this, and so he builds an altar, the outward sign that he really does accept God's promise. When I say Abraham, bear in mind that Abraham had 300 men at least, so I would imagine the total community that moved with Abraham was probably 600-700 people. He wasn't wandering around by himself. He was a chieftain of a very large clan. Now the people with him were not his descendants. They were all sorts of odds and ends of Syrians, Babylonians, or whatever they were. And they made a fairly large community wherever they went. This will come out as the story goes on. In chapter 12, verse 9, we are told that Abraham went on from Bethel south through the Negev. The Negev is the dry southern region of Palestine. You'll find it referred to frequently in our newspapers when you read of conflicts in Palestine today. The Negev is the area between the Dead Sea and the Mediterranean Sea, the dry southern part of Palestine. He came through there, and in verse 10 he found that there was a famine in the land. Well, that's a bit grim. Here he is, one minute expressing his faith in God, you've given me this great land, and the next minute there's a famine in the land and the place doesn't look so good after all. And that's very often the way you'll find it. You'll often find that you're riding the crest of a wave, you express your faith in God and you feel just great. Then the next day, suddenly the whole world seems to crumble. And then you're really put on the spot. Is your faith as good as you said it was? That's what Abraham's finding out now. Thank you for giving me this great land. Next minute, a drought. Some land. So, what happens? Well, we find that Abraham starts to buckle at the knees. He wanders off down to Egypt in verse 10 because the famine wasn't severe in Egypt. It was severe in Canaan, but not in Egypt. And he thought, well, he'll do better for himself down there. Well, I'm afraid one thing led to another. And once Abraham got down to Egypt, the next thing you know is he is deceiving the Egyptian king. Abraham's wife, Sarah, was very beautiful. And Abraham was frightened that this lusty king of Egypt, kings in those days had one-track minds, you know, any beautiful women around the place, they took them off into the harem and that was that. Abraham thought, well, if the king thinks I'm Sarah's husband, he might kill me and take off Sarah. So he and Sarah agreed between them that they'd tell everybody that she was his sister. This would preserve Abraham's skin. Also, hopefully, would be a sort of way of compromise of keeping things intact. In a sense, it was right because Sarah was Abraham's half-sister. They had the same father, but different mothers. But it was a deceit nevertheless. And if you tell only half the truth in order to conceal the full truth, then that's lies. That's deceit. And that's the thing that Abraham is condemned for. And it's very ripe among Christians, even today. In the end, when Pharaoh found out about it, he had to get rid of Abraham. He was very annoyed. And at the end of the chapter, he sends Abraham off. So in chapter 13, verse 1, we find that Abraham now leaves Egypt with his wife, with Lot, and with everything else they had. They were rich before. In verse 2, they are even richer. Abraham was very rich in cattle and silver and gold, and he journeyed on back up through the Negev to Bethel. And that riches is now going to pose a problem. This desire to accumulate material prosperity is a great evil. I'm not saying that material prosperity itself is wrong. I'm saying the desire to accumulate it is wrong. It's not money that is the root of all evil, but it's the love of money that's the root of all evil. And the desire for material prosperity, which nearly everybody in Australia seems to be hooked on, is a thoroughly non-Christian thing. And it will always create problems. It created problems here between Abraham and Lot. You find this conflict. Abraham adopted a noble attitude and Lot adopted a very selfish attitude. Because they didn't want to have fighting all the time, Abraham gave Lot the choice and he said, "You can have any portion of this land you like. You go and settle there with all your cattle and I'll take whatever's left." So he gave Lot first choice. Lot rubbed his hands together and, being a very selfish type, took what he thought was the best part of the land, and he went in and settled in a place called Sodom. Sodom doesn't exist now, and the place I've marked on the map is only a very rough approximation of where it might have been. Most likely it lies buried beneath the Dead Sea. Anyway, that's where he went and settled. And then Abraham went and settled on the other side of the Dead Sea in Hebron. You'll find it referred to in verse 18 of chapter 13. The whole of this story tells us how firm Abraham's faith was. If you go back in chapter 13 to verse 11, you find that Lot chose for himself all the Jordan Valley, and Lot journeyed east. Thus they separated from each other. Abraham dwelt in the land of Canaan, that is west of the Dead Sea, and Lot dwelt among the cities of the valley and moved his tent as far as Sodom, which was on the eastern side. But notice verse 13 that the men of Sodom were wicked, and they were great sinners against the Lord. And immediately following this in verse 14, you find God now comes and promises Abraham once again that he will bless him. There's a point here for us. Abraham was selfless and he gave Lot the first choice. God honored him for it. And then God came back to Abraham and said, "I will bless you. Lift up your eyes, look from the place where you are, look northward, southward, eastward, westward. All the land you see, I'll give it to you and to your descendants forever." So his unselfishness was honored by God. Lot's selfishness led him to ruin. One of the great Christian principles is that you love your neighbor as yourself, which is another way of saying you put your neighbor before yourself. That seems to be an old-fashioned principle which is very much dying out in our society, and Christians, I might add, are rather prone to forget it. Well, let's not forget it. Abraham didn't forget it, and you might have said he was putting everything at risk, but in the long run, God honored him because he acted in faith and he did what was right. You always do what is right, and you can be assured that in the long run, God will respect you for it. Well, he settles in Hebron in the last verse of chapter 13. Chapter 14 introduces us to a story that concerns Lot. The area where Lot settled, Sodom and all these other towns round about, was under the control of a number of kings from Babylonia. They're mentioned in the opening verses of chapter 4. Shinar is the land of Babylon, Elam is ancient Persia, and all those other towns around there were in the region of the Chaldees, Chaldea or Babylonia, if you like. And they had these various city-states around Sodom and that area under their control. Well, all those city-states decided they'd rebel and not pay their overlord any more cash. So the overlords raised an army from Mesopotamia. They came across through the Fertile Crescent, came down and attacked all these cities, carted off the people, plundered, looted, and took off not only all the plunder that they could find, but Lot and his family with them. News of this came to Abraham's ears, and so he rallied around and got these 300 men that he had in his camp, equipped them, and off they went as a sort of private army. They did battle with these invaders, managed to defeat them, regain the lost plunder, and regain Lot and his family. So they were returning home when the king of Sodom, the Lord Mayor, or whatever you like to call him, the chieftain of Sodom, came out and met Abraham as he returned. Another person met him, a man called Melchizedek. Now this Melchizedek tells us that there were other people scattered around who still maintained the belief in Jehovah, the belief in God. We know that Abraham did, and we've traced the thin line from Adam through Noah down to Abraham. But there were still the odds and ends around the place, and Melchizedek is one of them. In fact, he's a priest of God. He's a person who is very close to God, and he's a person who spiritually is on a higher level than Abraham. He's an intercessor, you might say, or a mediator through whom Abraham can approach God. Abraham recognizes this, and he worships God by giving to Melchizedek, who was God's representative, some offerings of the loot which he had taken. In turn, Melchizedek, on God's behalf, blessed Abraham. Now, the king of Sodom was there, and he said, "Well, thanks very much, Abraham, for helping us to win this victory. Take some of the loot and keep it for yourself." And Abraham said to the king of Sodom, "No thanks. You don't owe me anything, and I don't owe you anything. You're not the controller of this land. God is the controller of this land. I'm not accepting anything from your hand. I accept this victory solely from God, and I've given God the honor, and God's given me the blessing, so thanks very much, but you can go your way." And so he didn't take the rewards that the king of Sodom offered him. It's another way of Abraham demonstrating his faith that God was the sovereign controller of Canaan. Most of us, I would think, probably couldn't resist the temptation. You wangle a few dollars under somebody's nose, they find it very difficult to resist. And one of the things that all of us find or will find as we go on further is to stand on principle when it means that we're going to lose out on some financial gain. Living by faith is what the Christian life is all about. Don't think that that is a term that applies only to certain people who do Christian work full time, who don't know where their next income is coming from and they hope God will give it to them. That's not what living by faith means. Living by faith is the way you and I should live if we're Christians. We're saved by faith and we live by faith. The whole of our lives are lived in dependence upon God and in obedience to God's commands. Not by the things we see or the money we get do we live, but rather by a dependence upon God. We walk by faith, not by sight. Abraham demonstrates that and provides us with an example that I hope we'll follow. We move on now to chapter 15 and we find that Abraham's faith is tested even more. It's already been tested in relation to the land, because firstly, there was a drought, which doesn't augur well for the future. Secondly, there's fighting and squabbling going on in this land that is promised to him, so that's not very pleasant either. And now the promise concerning the family, that's running into problems, because he and his wife are old and getting older. They don't have any children. Sarah had some sort of problem, and she couldn't have children. And the older they got, the less likely it became that they would ever have children. In chapter 15, when Abraham is considering this problem and what he's going to do about it, God says to him in verse 5, "Look toward heaven and count the stars, if you're able to." And he said to Abraham, "So shall your descendants be." Don't worry, Abraham, you may be 90 odd years of age, but I'm going to work this miracle nevertheless, and you'll have a lot of descendants. Verse 6, Abraham believed the Lord, and God reckoned it to him as righteousness. God is always looking for faith, and the only way anybody ever has been saved, or ever will be saved, as far as I can see, is through faith. People in the Old Testament times were not saved through keeping the law. They were saved the same way as you and I are saved. That is, as you come to God and you trust him, you believe him. And if there's no faith, you haven't pleased God. Without faith, it's impossible to please God. We are saved by faith, and that verse there that we've just read about Abraham being saved by faith is used as the basis of Paul's argument on salvation by faith that he gives in the book of Romans. We are saved by God's grace. We don't earn it by our works. We are sinful. We have fallen short of God's standards, yet God in his grace loves us and he saves us, and we accept his salvation by faith. And here again, God makes this promise to Abraham. Abraham and his wife don't seem to be able to have these children that they want, but God says, "Believe me, I'll give them to you." Abraham accepts God's word, he believes, and because of his faith, God accepts him. It's always the basis of faith, which is the course of our salvation. Just to prove it, God confirms his promise in a covenant ceremony. We mentioned yesterday what a covenant is. It's an agreement between two people. Now, in ancient times, they had a very graphic way of making sure people kept the covenant. You'll find it referred to a number of times, and here in chapter 15 there's a story about it. I'll explain briefly what they did. The two contracting parties would get some animals and they'd carve them down the middle. This is gory stuff. They'd carve these animals down the middle and put the two halves of the animals over against each other with a passageway between. And then the two people would walk down between the halves of these slaughtered animals and call down upon themselves the fate of those animals should they break their part of the covenant. And that's a pretty dramatic way of swearing that you're going to keep your promise. Now, in this case, we find that only God passed between the parts of these dismembered animals. It's referred to in verse 17, God, symbolized by a smoking fire pot and a flaming torch, passed between these pieces. And he made a covenant with Abraham, saying, to your descendants I will give this land. And he outlines the borders of it and mentions all the various people who live in it there in verse 19. What God is doing is saying, I will give you this land freely by my grace. Salvation is always by God's grace. God says, I will give it to you. I am the sole contracting party. All you have to do is accept my promise, believe it by faith, and be obedient to my commands. Just before we leave chapter 15, there are some very important verses which I feel we must read, verse 13 through to verse 16, because these verses contain the explanation of the stories that follow later concerning Jacob, Joseph, and the captivity in Egypt. God says in chapter 15, verse 13, know of a surety that your descendants will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs, that is the land of Egypt. They will be slaves there and will be oppressed for 400 years. But I will bring judgment on the nation which they serve, I'll judge the Egyptians, and afterwards they, the Israelites, shall come out with great possessions, as they did under Moses. As for yourself, you shall go to your fathers in peace and shall be buried at a good old age. And they, your descendants, shall come back here into Canaan after they've been in Egypt, in the fourth generation, for the iniquity of the Amorites or the Canaanites is not yet complete. Now the whole of the stories that are going to follow will show us how it came to be that the Israelites did finish up in Egypt and then later on came out. God said, the time is not yet ripe for you to take the land of Canaan. Abraham, with only 300 men, was in no position to take the land of Canaan. He would have been wiped out himself. So God said, what I'll do is get you out of this land of Canaan for a few hundred years, and your descendants will multiply and multiply and multiply and multiply until they are a nation in their own right. Then when the fitting time has come, I'll bring them back and they'll storm the place and they'll take it by conquest. By that time, the Amorites would have been so wicked that they would have deserved God's punishment. This verse really helps to explain Joshua's conquest of Canaan, which you read about later on. And his extermination of the Canaanites was well deserved because of the iniquity of the Canaanites. God gave them this opportunity to repent, but they didn't repent. God always gives us the opportunity to repent, but sooner or later the time is going to run out. God is long-suffering and forbearing. He doesn't want any to perish. And so he gives them 400 years to change their ways. But in the end he says, I know that they won't change their ways. And sooner or later the judgment is going to fall, and it is for all of us likewise. God gives us the opportunity to repent, but God is not going to hang off and hang off and hang off indefinitely. Judgment is a very real thing. Let us take the opportunity of receiving God's grace while we have it. Well, now, as you come down to chapter 16, you find that the people, Abraham, Sarah, and their tribal group, or whatever you like to call it, they have now been in Canaan 10 years, and Abraham and Sarah still don't have any children. God reassures them that they will have children. Sarah suggested a way out. This was common in ancient times. She said to Abraham, look, obviously I can't have any children. We want to have children. Well, here's my maid, Hagar. She was an Egyptian girl. Can you produce a child through her? And then the child so born would legally become the child of Abraham and Sarah. Hagar was simply a child-producing machine. When the child was born, Hagar would have no rights over it. The child would belong to Sarah. Abraham went along with this. It was a common practice in those days, and a child was born, and they called his name Ishmael. And God said, I'm sorry, Abraham, Ishmael is not the one. That is not the way I am going to give you your descendants. The descendants are going to come from you and Sarah, not from a sort of substitute wife, but from Sarah herself. And just to prove it, I'll give you a new name, Abraham, which means in chapter 17, verse 5, no longer shall your name be Abram, your name shall be Abraham, for I have made you a father of a multitude of nations. Then verse 16, concerning Sarah, I will bless her, and moreover, I will give you a son by her, and I will bless her, and she shall be a mother of nations. So Abraham's to be the father, and Sarah is to be the mother. they are to have children born to them. God then sealed this covenant, which is outlined in chapter 17, which I hope you read this morning, through the ceremony of circumcision. That is, Abraham and all the males in his household had to undergo the rite of circumcision. That is, a permanent distinguishing mark was put in the body as an assurance to them that they were God's people. The book of Romans in the New Testament tells us that in the case of Abraham, this circumcision sealed his faith. It demonstrated his obedience. And in the case of the people, it marked them off as God's people. Notice once again how the covenant originates with God, but the men must respond in faith and obedience. Those who obeyed were said to have kept the covenant. Those who disobeyed were cut off from the covenant. Faith and obedience, they always go together. You can't have one without the other. And I'm afraid there is a drift or abroad these days, a sort of easy believism, where people say all you need to do is believe, and then they get assurance and they sing happy choruses. And there's not much obedience. It's just believe, believe, believe. But a belief that doesn't have obedience linked with it is not true belief. You cannot separate faith and obedience. And if you get a person who says he believes, but obviously is not obeying, well, then you have no obligation to believe that person's profession of faith. We are all entitled to assurance, but we are not entitled to assurance if we are deliberately disobedient. And the New Testament is full of instructions to this end. It wants us to have assurance of our salvation. It does not want us to be complacent, to have some sort of pat assurance where we think that because we recited a few words when we were so many years old and we wrote the date in the back of our Bibles that therefore we're saved. That's not good enough. We have to be living a life of obedience to God if we're entitled to have the assurance of our salvation that the Bible wants us to have. And you'll find as you move on that Abraham demonstrated his faith time and time again by obedience. And that's the way you and I demonstrate our faith. And if there's no obedience, it's probably because there's no real faith there in the first place. Now all this time, Abraham is in Hebron. And in chapter 18, he is visited by three men. These three men are messengers from God. Very much like the figure that we meet repeatedly in the early books of the Bible, who is called the angel of the Lord. The word angel and the word messenger are the same. And this angel of the Lord is so closely identified with God that it seems almost as if the person is God. When he speaks, God speaks. And the angel's temporary appearance is as if it is God's temporary appearance there before them. And so these three people bring to Abraham the message from God. Sarah apparently didn't share Abraham's faith to the extent she should have. And these three men came to assure her that God's promise would be fulfilled, she would get pregnant, and within 12 months she would have a child. It's very important that the husband and the wife are compatible. It's not much good if the husband has a strong faith and the wife has a weak faith, or vice versa. It's one of the things we must consider concerning any prospects of marriage that might be in our minds. It's not simply a case of a Christian marrying a Christian. There's a lot more to it than that. There must be this compatibility between husband and wife, so that spiritually one can answer to the other. And if one is strong and one isn't strong, well, then you're heading for all sorts of problems. And here it was that Abraham's faith was strong, Sarah's wasn't as strong as it should be. And so these three men came because they wanted to strengthen it, so that the two of these people could enter into the blessings of God's promises equally. There's a verse in Peter that tells us that if there's any conflict or tension between the husband and wife, then their prayers won't be effective. It's a great hindrance to our prayer life when there is no compatibility between the husband and the wife. Not only did they reassure Sarah, but they told Abraham that Sodom was about to be overthrown. Now, while we've been going through these other chapters, things have been happening in Sodom, and the place has been getting worse and worse. It was a place full of sexual perverts of various types. And Lot, although he was a believer in God, was a very weak sort of a one. He himself carried on his belief in God, but he didn't oppose the sins of society. He didn't speak out against the sins of society. I think we should speak out against the sins of society. I think it's one of our jobs as Christians to stand up and be counted, to speak against some of the aberrations that we witness here. Well, Lot didn't, and he is indeed a very pathetic figure. Not only did he not oppose the wickedness, but when a bunch of perverts came to his house demanding that they satisfy their perversions on one of his guests, Lot was even prepared to sacrifice his daughter's virginity in order to save his own skin. Lovely father, this man. in the end, he had to be actually dragged from the city to escape the judgment which God was sending upon it. You see, Abraham had prayed earlier for his nephew and prayed that these might be delivered from the impending judgment upon Sodom. But you see, Lot had become so much part of his society that he didn't want to give it up. A lot of Christians like that. They get so at home in the world that they really lose their Christian principle altogether. And they get hooked on all these things about making money and getting prosperous and being a man of status in the place. And Lot was like that. Well, eventually they managed to get him out just in the nick of time, and then the city went up in smoke. You know the story of the fire and the brimstone. Back in chapter 14, we are told that there were lots of bitumen pits, tar pits in the region. And there's also a lot of sulfur and natural gases in the region. All it needed, of course, was some sort of volcanic activity to ignite the lot, and next minute you have the whole place exploding, fire and brimstone showering down upon the people, and so the city was buried. And Lot's wife, one of them, when she dallied and got a dose of this molten stuff over the top of her. Well, Lot escaped, and his two daughters. Now, his two daughters were little better than prostitutes. They had been well corrupted by the evil of the city, and they said, well, all the people in Sodom are destroyed and we've got no husbands. We don't want to be virgins forever, we'd like to have some children. So what they did was to get their father merry one night, and they incited him. And first one girl had sex with him and she got pregnant, and then the next one. And so it was that the two daughters of Lot produced two children. One of them was called Moab and one was called Ammon, and they became the forefathers of the races of Moab and Ammon, who later developed in the area just east of Israel. It's a very sad story, thrown there in the middle of this good story concerning Abraham's faith. Well, Abraham in chapter 20, verse 1, moves down to a place called Gerar, which is down in the land of the Philistines, and the Philistines occupied the coastal plain area of the Negev over there on the Mediterranean coast. You have a story once again of how Abraham slipped, and he continued to lie concerning his wife Sarah. He was frightened that Abimelech, the leader of the Philistines, would whip off Sarah for himself and maybe dispatch Abraham just to make sure there was no competition. And to preserve himself alive, Abraham and Sarah once again lied. When Abimelech found out, he was shocked. Sarah escaped any molesting from him. It was while Abraham was in Gerar that Isaac, the promised son, was born. That is, born to Sarah and Abraham. Once again, it demonstrates to us God's grace. Here we are on the very threshold of the fulfillment of the promise, and yet Abraham is still making these slips and stumbles. This is the way life is, isn't it? We go along and we stumble. Well, human nature is like that. Nobody's perfect. Abraham, who was one of the greatest men who ever lived, was not perfect, and he made these slips all the time. But God doesn't throw us out for one slip. And even though Abraham stumbled here once again with his deceit concerning his wife, God went ahead with his promise, and in due course the baby was born, proving to us again that everything is of God's grace, not of man's achievement. Abraham was not saved by his good works, because this illustrates to us that his works were not always good. He was saved by his faith. After Isaac was born, Ishmael, the previously born son, was expelled. By this time Ishmael was a lusty teenager, and he and his mother, there was a bit of conflict in the camp. You'll always get conflict in the camp when a man has more than one wife in the household and he's got children by various wives all living under the one roof. It's not to be wondered at that you do get a few conflicts. In the end, we find that Ishmael and his mother had to leave. Abraham continued in chapter 21 in the land of the Philistines. He went from Gerar across to Beersheba. And in Beersheba, we notice that there was a dispute over wells of water. This was a very dry area, and shepherds were always fighting with each other over who owned the wells around the place. So Abimelech, the leader of the Philistines, and Abraham entered a sort of covenant, an agreement that they wouldn't fight any longer. The story is outlined for you in chapter 21. You come to chapter 22, and by this time Isaac is now a strapping teenager. Time moves along very quickly in these stories. Now we find that God tests Abraham's faith once again. He tells Abraham to take his son Isaac to a place called Moriah, which I've noted on the map there. It really is identified roughly with Jerusalem. I want you to take him to Moriah and sacrifice him. And by sacrifice, we mean put him on an altar and kill him and offer him as a human sacrifice to God. Now, this was not something which Abraham would have been unfamiliar with, because human sacrifice was practiced throughout that region. it would have taken him by storm, it would have shocked him, but it was not by any means unknown to him, and although he may have balked at it and thought it unusual, nevertheless he was sufficiently familiar with the practice to think, oh well, I'd better go ahead and do it, God has said. But immediately now there's a conflict in Abraham, a conflict between faith and obedience. He has faith in God's promises that God is going to give him a multitude of descendants through this son, but if he is obedient to God, he's going to kill that son. How do you work it out? You obey God and you kill the son through whom God has said you're going to have a multitude of descendants. So faith was in conflict here with obedience. What did Abraham do? He went ahead in obedience. He said, well, God has told me to do that. I guess God knows what he's doing. I'll go ahead and sacrifice him. And he believed that God would answer the problem. You see, his faith was still strong, and his faith was proving itself by his obedience. He said, if I sacrifice this son, I'm confident that God will raise him from the dead. And so I can be obedient, and God's promise will still be fulfilled. And that's what it says in Hebrews chapter 11 and also in James chapter 2, that Abraham demonstrated the sincerity and the genuineness of his faith by obedience. As it so happened, once God saw that he was genuine, God said, well, all right, I don't want you to sacrifice your son. That is, I don't want you to kill him. And he offered a ram instead. But in effect, Abraham did sacrifice his son. He was prepared to. He went all the way. He passed the test and showed that he was serious in doing whatever God told him to do, believing that God could reverse the death and bring his son back to life and so still fulfill his promise of a multitude of descendants. So Abraham, in effect, both gave his son and had him given back to him. That is why it is that God then blesses Abraham, because obedience always brings blessing. Now, there's a principle in the Bible that you'll get right through the scriptures. Obedience brings blessing, disobedience brings cursing. And it was when Abraham demonstrated his obedience in chapter 22, verse 16, that God said, by myself I have sworn, says the Lord, because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will indeed bless you. I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven, so there's the people, and as the sand of the seashore. Your descendants shall possess the gate of their enemies, so they shall dwell in this land. And by your descendants shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. And so there's the third part of the promise concerning the salvation ultimately to come through Jesus Christ. Abraham returned from Mount Moriah in verse 19 to Beersheba. And then in chapter 23, verse 2, he moved from Beersheba back to Hebron. And there in Hebron, he bought a burial plot for his wife Sarah, who had now passed away. And the story of how he bought it from the people is outlined there in chapter 23. This again was an expression of Abraham's faith. He was living in the land that God had promised him, but he owned none of it. Before he died, he wanted personally to own a few square meters. As an outward expression of his faith, I own at least 50 square meters of this land, and my descendants will one day own the rest. So as a demonstration of his faith, he negotiated to buy a plot of land. And then he said, Sarah will be buried here in the land which her descendants will one day occupy. And when I die, I want to be buried here too. Later on, when his son died, he was to be buried there, and Rebekah, his wife. Jacob was to be buried there in that same plot of ground. They were demonstrating their faith by being buried in this plot of ground and saying, although at present we don't possess this land totally for ourselves, we still hang on to God's promises, because sometimes it takes a long time for God to bring his purposes to fulfillment. But we still believe, and we'll hang on in faith, and we'll demonstrate our faith by buying this plot of land